I want to do this out there where we could model every species, even every life history stage, and then condense the models arbitrarily in various ways. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I got the grant for. And I had a series of grants from 1968, well, really through 1985, 1987, when the last grant, formal grant for out there ended. Mm-hmm. But from the period 1968, the 5 years from 1968 to 1973, that's when I did the bulk of the early work on the modeling out there. Developed a model, developed some rules for condensing models, and went around here telling everybody, well, I can tackle a complex system now. So in 1973, I don't know if this still fits in with your question, but it's on my research.
Go ahead.
I'll just finish this. And in 1973, Pomeroy was just starting a major multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary, I should say, team effort to study Sapelo Island from the standpoint of trying to find out what's missing in our picture of carbon flow down there. What factors are we not do we not know enough about, and so on and so forth. And they proposed to support one of my graduate students, Richard Wetzel at the time, for work down there, one of my new graduate students. And in return for that, I said, well, I ought to do something for you if you're supporting one of my graduates. And he said, well, sit in on our monthly meetings of our group. And I did. The very first one, they proposed doing this model, and I started asking them questions about the model, and the net result was, after about half an hour, Palmer said, well, you're saying that you can model a complex system. Why don't you do our model for us in the salt marsh? So that's how I got involved in salt marsh work. And so what I've tried to do with that salt marsh work is extend my approaches to modeling to encompass a much more complex mm-hmm. community.
Compacting them into the groups.
Yeah, well, using some of the rules to construct that model and so forth. But along the way, I found out that one of the major uses of ecological modeling, in addition to developing theory, in addition to maybe occasionally doing actual predictions for an applied management objective, mm-hmm. that one of the most useful things is simply to guide a large interdisciplinary research approach, because you can ask questions. You've always got limited money and limited manpower. So you ask the question, well, which of these gaps in my knowledge or our knowledge about this system is the thing we ought to concentrate on now, or which are the things we ought to concentrate on now? And so you can ask your model, assuming the model includes all the up-to-date information you've got on the system at that point, you can ask the model, well, what's the sensitivity of some of these? In other words, do I spend time trying to find out more about the anaerobic respiration loss of carbon down there, or is it really the carbon that's used by respiration of organisms migrating onto the marsh that I ought to be trying to refine my estimate of? Say, which is the most important in terms of which one of these, if changed, will make the biggest impact on the model exactly. predictions now in the long run.
Okay. So it gave you a
so
direction.
It gives you a way to sort of synthesize the information you now have and project it into the future and say, okay, what's the best bet for me right now? Mm-hmm. What should I concentrate on?
Okay.
And that's basically what.
And that's what you've been doing to the present
and
then?
Up till the present time, I'm still doing some work in Yellowstone, but the major work now is Great Sample.
Okay. For the tape, could you just say who Dr. Pomeroy is? Could give his full name and title.
Oh, yeah, he's probably another one you want to interview, actually. Lawrence Pomeroy. He's recently retired last year, but he's still very active. He's got grants at the university, and he still works every day in his office. In fact, the reason he said he retired is so he could spend more time on his research. He doesn't have to teach
anything. I've been glad. That's a good one. And he was formerly the director of the Institute of Ecology, correct?
No.
Oh.
He was never director of the Institute of Ecology. He was, for a while, a chairman of the zoology department.
Okay.
The directors, Well, you can probably get the history of that from the Gali or Odom if you do it, but the history of the Institute is an interesting one, actually. Later on, you might want to do
that. Yeah, I'll ask him about that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Of the research that we've just discussed, we've done this a little bit, but kind of just give us a synopsis of what that research has done to further ecology specifically in terms of the whole picture.
Okay, well, I'd return to the modeling again, then. I'd say that while I've been very interested in working myself and my students and postdoctoral associates both in Yellowstone and at Sapelo, I'm working on specific hands-on biological problems that deal with particular consumer groups in each of these ecosystems, mm-hmm. That the overall value to ecology has been the synthesis of this information in a form that permits more realistic, and by realistic I mean ecologically realistic models. That is, models that have in them parameters that can be measured, not just parameters put in for the sake of improving the fit to the data, like a regression model, but rather mechanistic models.
So real world more.
In which the parameters, you can say, okay, I can go out and measure this and refine my measurement of this value.
Right, okay.
And so I'd say that's been I consider the major value of my research has been to promote the development of mechanistic models in a form in which they will realistically predict the behavior of ecosystems.
Okay. Well, this kind of is a... We'll skip that question.
Well, it was,
how has your work added to or changed our modern views of the environment and ecology, if that's any different from what we just discussed?
Not really. I mean, that's basically what I would answer.
Okay. Then the next question is, what are your personal thoughts and feelings about nature and environment and the environment?
Well, I really like it. You
said you like to fish, so I mean you must have like an appreciation of this.
Oh, yeah. Well, I like to backpack and hike, and when I was younger I used to do a lot of mountain climbing. Well, I think it's very important to maintain, both from a scientific viewpoint as a reservoir of natural areas, but also from an aesthetic, psychological viewpoint for the human species. I think it's very important to maintain as much as we can areas in the environment that are undeveloped in terms of a minimal impact by human beings, just as an example of how the environment functioned, or at least as close as we can come to an example of how the environment functioned before man had a big impact on it. One of the reasons I'm very attracted to coastal tidal marshes is for that very reason. They're probably the best examples in the world. Coastal tidal marshes that are dominated by grasses, at least, not necessarily mangroves. They're the best examples in the world of ecosystems that haven't been significantly modified by human activities, at least if they haven't been destroyed.
Right.
A lot of them have been diked and filled and
paved over
and so forth, and obviously those have been impacted.
Yeah.
But if they exist at all, they probably haven't been greatly modified due to the very fact that they're very sensitive to change. Change, for example, in flow rate of the water will drastically impact a Spartina marsh. So as long as it's still a Spartina marsh, it hasn't been changed much. And do you know that they're one of the few ecosystems in the world where there's almost no weed species? There are no introduced insects that we know of that have taken over and become dominant. There are no introduced plants that have taken over and been dominant. And you can say that about almost no other area in the world except maybe the boreal forest or the tundra.
So is it just the tightness of the ecosystem, the way it
And
functions?
Even there, in the boreal forest and the tundra, man has had a huge impact on the large mammalian consumers. And so we don't know what it was really like before there were people there, and there were lots of large mammalian consumers. We don't know what the tundra was like when there were vast herds of musk ox, for example. Mm-hmm. We don't know what the plains were like when the buffalo were here.
Right, right.
But there were no large mammalian consumers in the salt marshes, and so man didn't remove them. They just never were there. So I think it's a good example of ecosystems that, if it exists today, it probably looks pretty much like it did forever.
Almost a pristine state.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Rather interesting. But anyway, I digressed a bit. I think that's why I'm interested in the salt marsh, because I think it's very important that we try as hard as we can to maintain at least some areas that are really relatively unmodified. But having said that, we face the fact that we've got an ever-expanding population, and unless the human species as a whole can come to grips with maintaining a zero growth for the world as a whole, mm-hmm. We're going to have a hard time doing that. I mean, I think my thoughts are about the environment is that it's in a very precarious state. Not due to so much to willful destruction as just the very fact that there's so many people. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the worst destruction is taking place today, not in the industrialized countries, but in third world countries where it's just simply population pressure. There was a very good program I heard on PBS the other day on the radio listening to. They were interviewing people in various third world countries throughout the world. And much as you're doing, only interviewing people like village elders and so forth in both Africa and Asia. And they were talking about the old days when they had plenty of land for farming. They could afford to leave the land fallow for 10 years before they touched it again, so it maintained its fertility. Mm-hmm. You know, they were just talking about the fact that things like they don't have enough land to leave it fertile. You know, they have to use the land, and the yields are going down, mm-hmm. and they don't have trees for firewood anymore. And basically, what's the world coming to? You know,
yeah.
I mean, and they were just throughout all of these interviews, you just got this sense of these were people that were just at sea, so to speak. I mean, they just really didn't understand what was happening, except for the fact that they realized that there were just too many people. They kept mm-hmm. reiterating.
So they knew that there were too many people, but they didn't.
You know, really how it happened, or
they didn't really tie it together.
Of course, unfortunately, the major reason it's happened is that modern medicine has drastically lowered the death rate of infants, mm-hmm. which, you know, is a very good thing. But if you don't couple that with lowering the production rate of infants, the ultimate is suffering not of the infants now, but suffering when they become adults.
Yeah, it's just overproduction of infants, right. Okay.
Anyway, I think that's the biggest. I think that's the biggest single problem that faces the world today is environmental degradation, simply because of too many people.
Population, right? And the implications that it would have in other terms of consumerism and things, I guess. Or just
well, yeah. I mean, it's even. Of course, it's even worse in so-called developed countries if also there is unrestricted growth, mm-hmm. I mean, or positive growth. A lot of the developed countries have more or less started to come into balance.
Coming low, right. Okay. We kind of touched on this a little while ago. Have you ever taken part in a social or political movement for the environment, such as, you know, a particular environmental legislation, demonstrations, rallies?
Yeah, not specifically. I mean, a lot of my work for the EPA, of course, has a very applied nature. In fact, almost all of it has a very applied nature. Mm-hmm. Right now, for example, I'm involved in putting the finishing touches on a document, a preliminary document on ecological risk assessment. Mm-hmm. The EPA is trying to develop a set of guidelines for assessing risk to ecosystems in the same way they did 15 years ago for assessing risk to humans from toxic materials.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're trying to do the same for ecosystems that they did for human health. And that's a it's an ongoing effort. It's been going on now about 3 years, and we've just finished the first document. So I think you can say that's an applied, very applied objective. But I haven't taken part in any real demonstrations for the environment.
Well, your Earth Day appearances.
Well, the Earth Day appearances, yes, were talks in support of
that. Right. So, okay. Anything else?
I've done a lot of work in Spain, actually, as part of a grant that, it was some money that was given ultimately by the State Department through NOAA